This is Sabrina George interviewing Nick Wilty for New Comedy Radio by the River Thames on a late Monday afternoon. Well, yeah, late Monday afternoon, really. So, Nick, first question I have to ask you, what got you to take the action of becoming a comic rather than thinking about it?
For me, it was forced circumstance. I was in Canada and I lost my passport and my money. I couldn't do the plans I wanted to do, which was go and see a girl in Hawaii on a boat that I was going to get on. So I was telling somebody how I'd lost my passport, and he said you should tell it on stage. That's a funny story. So that's how it started.
And when they paid you?
My first one was free, but I got free alcohol, which was my incentive to do it. And then the next week they paid me $10 for 10 minutes. So I thought, well, that's not bad. You know, I was earning $40 a day delivering Yellow Pages. And then the following week, I got my first paid gig, $120 for 20 minutes, and I turned professional 2 weeks after I'd set foot on stage.
Did you stay in Canada?
Yeah, I stayed in Canada for 5 months, and then I came second in this competition to find Canada's funniest new comedian, and they put a big splurge about me in the paper, you know, London Drifter wins Comedy Award. And immigration got onto the club and said, is he Canadian? You said London. Is that London, Ontario, or London where? They went, oh no, England. I said, right, has he got a work permit? No. Well, I'll have to get out of the country. So they deported me.
But gave you a passport at the same time?
Well, no, in that 5 months I'd got myself a new passport, you know. But I still hadn't got a work permit. I was in Canada on a holiday visa. And it's just unfortunate, really. The prize was to go and work in America. And they wouldn't let me in America because I had no work permit. And Canada wouldn't let me stay for the same reason. So I was in a catch-22 situation. I could get a work permit if I left Canada, but they wouldn't let me in America to get one. So they gave me, it wasn't actually a deportation, it was called a departure order. They put me on the flight that I had to pay for, and the moment it's about to take off, the immigration guy leaves the plane, they shut the door, they know that I'm definitely leaving the country. So that was it.
Brilliant. Yeah. So what, then you came to back to England and you just carried on as you'd left off, or what happened then?
No, I started all over again over here. I was doing very well in Canada, but in England I didn't know about the comedy circuit, so the first thing I did was one of these things I read about in the stage magazine called Search a Star down in Great Yarmouth on the pier. I died a horrendous death, but the guy who runs it, he said something that really influenced me, and he said, you're two Channel 4, mate. To Channel 4, you're not cut out for this sort of stuff.
Meaning too alternative?
To alternative, yeah, because I was doing my own jokes and I was talking about topical events, and he said it'll never work in places like this, the end of the pier. You know, they didn't get you. He said, but I know you're good. What you need is you need to be on the alternative comedy scene, which I never knew existed. So I did another one on Worthing Pier and had the same result and pretty much the same sort of conversation. Bloke said, you're really good, but it's not going to work on this circuit. You're not cut out for end of the pier. You need to go alternative comedy. So I was working in my dad's pub, and one of my brothers...
Where was that?
In Hastings, right, south coast of England. And one of my brothers said, there's a huge alternative comedy scene in London. That's where you want to go. And he got hold of a copy of Time Out magazine, which had all the listings.
Yeah.
And
fine.
So it, as soon as I found that, I mean, I just knew I'd struck gold. You know, I did a pub in Catford, and it was people like me, you know, people with stories to tell, and no one was telling structured jokes that they'd heard before. They were all writing their own stuff. And I knew immediately that I'd found what I was looking for, you know.
What were you doing before?
Well,
apart from delivering Yellow Pages in Canada.
The reason I was in Canada, I was hitchhiking around the world for 8 years, and I'd got into delivering yachts. I'd delivered a yacht from Spain to Barbados, and then another one up through the Caribbean to Florida, and then worked on boats in Boston and Marblehead. And the plan was to go to Vancouver, over the border in Seattle, get on a boat to Hawaii, meet the girl I've been chasing for years, and then carry on around the world. That was the plan. And comedy sort of stopped me in my tracks.
Took you in a completely different direction. So you had quite a lot of, for want of a better term, life experience to draw on.
Yeah, well, I'd had 6 years in the army and 8 years backpacking before I became a comedian.
What were you doing in the army?
I was a signal bloke. I was a radio telegraphist, which meant I sent and received Morse code.
Was that from all around the world?
11 countries, so I was in, yeah. So, but I bought myself out of the army after the Falklands. I realised that I didn't like, I liked the job, but I didn't want to be shot at.
Quite wise, really.
Yeah, and I wanted to find something that gave me the same buzz without the danger. So hitchhiking around the world seemed like the best bet. You know, every day is a different day, and it's adventurous and exciting. You don't know where you're going to end up, who you're going to end up with, but you're not going to get shot, hopefully, you know.
So did you pick up an agent quite quickly when you got to London? Or did you still...
No, what happened with me is that after about 2 years of doing comedy, I got offered a role in a TV show. He was a presenter on the Steve Wright show. And they offered me quite a lot of money, but I didn't have a clue whether it was good or bad. So I contacted an agent and said, that I've got a job on BBC One on Saturday nights, and they've offered me quite a lot of money. Is this about right, or should I get more? And she went, oh, you should be getting a lot more than that. So it went from the hundreds to the thousands. So I signed with an agent called the Richard Stone Partnership, and they got me about five or six times what I'd originally been offered, plus extra money for rehearsals, money for every interview. So I went from, you know, hundreds to thousands every week, you know.
And what when you went in for that first 2 years, were you just doing it by word of mouth, how to get gigs, how to get paid?
No, I was actually quite shrewd. I worked out pretty early on the best way to get gigs was to ring people up when they're not going to be there and leave a message. Don't leave your phone number. And what I'd do, I'd always maintain that I lived in the middle of nowhere. I lived in Kent, so it wasn't very far from London, but I always said, I live right down in Kent. Now, I'm going to be in your club on Friday night. I'm wondering if it's okay to do an open spot. If there's any problems, call us back. Anyway, my name's Nick Wilty, by the way. Hopefully I'll see you Friday. Bye. Wouldn't leave a message. And then, of course, when I turn up, they say, I've got your message. You didn't leave a phone. Oh, damn. Well, I've come all the way up from Kent. I didn't hear that I couldn't do it. So most of them were pretty good and say, well, if you've come all that way, at least I can do is give you 5 minutes, you know. So that was one of the ways of doing it. And the other way was using recommendations from people who were already working there. Like the people who were very, very good to me when I started, people like Joe Brand, Kevin Day, Jack D. I'd be doing an open spot. They'd see me and say, are you not getting paid work? I'd go, no, I'm still doing open spots. And they'd say, well, look, here's my home phone number. By all means, drop it in the conversation next time you're talking about an open spot. So, oh, by the way, Joe Brand said that she thinks I should be getting paid, and here's her number if you want to check. And that opened a lot of doors for me.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
Brilliant. So, were you beginning to earn a reasonable income right from the off?
No, I had about a year of pretty much the only money I had coming in. I'd go along to the Comedy Cafe every Wednesday, and the winner got £25. And it used to alternate between me and Tim Vine, and occasionally Rudy Liquid. We were the only ones who ever won it, really. But I regarded it as part of my income every second week, because they wouldn't let me win twice, you know, because you win it and then you go back as a headliner the following week. So I had 25 quid every second week. For moral reasons and trying to avoid the army, I wouldn't go on a dole, because then the army would know I was back in the country. So I had no income, but I hitchhiked everywhere, took my own beer, and that's how I did it, really, you know, and gradually it built up.
And then when you got this agent, you started hitting really good money?
No, the agent came after a couple of years.
Right.
The first thing that happened, after about a year, I was talking to Alan Davis, and he had gone on the Enterprise Allowance Scheme. And there's loads of us did it. I think Eddie Izzard did it, Alan Davis did it. And the government gave you £40 a week to practice and rehearse and all the rest. You had to say you were doing 40 hours a week. So you'd say, oh yeah, I spend... I told them I was a magician as well, and I said, obviously I have to sit down doing magic tricks, maybe. In reality, it just meant that I got paid £40 a week to go out gigging.
Was that for 2 years?
For a year, you get it.
You get it?
You get it for a year, yeah. £40 a week. And they give you a travel allowance, and I could reclaim things like costume, and I claimed that everything I wore was a costume. I mean, you know that I wear pretty outlandish clothes, so I mean, people presume that's just for stage, but that's what I dress like anyway. So it works out. I mean, basically, you're getting subsidised to be a comedian. And then you declare what you're earning, and they take that into account at the end of the year. And so at the end of my second year, I was earning enough money that I didn't need the Enterprise Allowance Scheme. And, you know, and then the TV came in, and then the agent came on the scene, and that's how it worked for me.
And it worked out. That's how it worked out for you financially. What about material? Because at the moment, I would say, I mean, the act that you do now, I would say, is very gag based.
Yeah.
And I would say, yes, they're tied together in topics, which can make them a story, but you're not really a storyteller.
Well, I'm
so how did you change that? Oh, you are given the chance?
Yeah, given the chance. The trouble is, if you're doing 20 minutes in a club, you've got to be funny but every 30 seconds. You've just got to keep telling jokes. You give me an hour show, like when I've done the Edinburgh Festival 15 times now, and Glastonbury 12 times, you know, festivals around the world. Where I'm doing an hour or more, then I'll get into what I think is story mode, where you get the elongated version of the story that you wouldn't, you know, I mean, I could tell you, on stage, I'll do a 5-minute routine about when I got held up by bandits in Paraguay. In a one-man show, that story lasts about 20 minutes because it's, you know, explaining how I got to the situation to be in Paraguay, to be held up by bandits. But you can't spend 20 minutes in the Comedy Store building up to one story. So I'll do the story and I'll whittle it down to about 2 or 3 minutes, get to the prescient points. So I'm on holiday, I've been to the carnival in Rio de la Dura, I was in Paraguay, and every link line has got a joke in it, so they don't notice that they're actually getting a condensed version of the long story.
Right, and how did you learn to do that, being a storyteller?
Just practice, there's no other way, stage time. You know, sometimes people will ask for more afterwards, you know, people come up and say, I'd love to know what happened in the end of that story, or, you know, what happened after Paraguay, where did you go then? So then I realised there was a demand for it, you know, and that's where festivals come in very handy, you know.
You can put in the longer...
You can tell the long, true story. You know, I did a show once in Edinburgh, the Wilt as well, just about my travels, and every night was a different show because the audience set the agenda. I'd say, look, I think at that point I've been to 68 countries, and I'd say, look, I've been to a lot of countries, and on the blackboard behind me I had A to Z, and next to each letter I had countries written. Now you can either shout out a country at random, or you can point to a letter, or just ask me a question about anything, and I will pinpoint what happened to me, how I got to that point. So every show was different completely. Now that's not true on the Comedy Circuit.
No.
You would not get work at Jongleurs in the Comedy Store if every time you went on stage you didn't know what you were going to say at the beginning. And You've got to set an agenda, you've got to be funny all the way through. Now, some of my stories are long-winded and beautiful, but they're not gagging texts, you know?
Yeah.
But you can do that in a one-man show. People know what they're coming for. They've read about the show, they're aware of what they've let themselves in for. If you said you're doing an hour of stand-up, and you did one story that lasts 20 minutes, and then maybe 2 or 3 more stories, they'd feel a bit short-changed. And that's the case in most comedy clubs. You haven't got the liberty to go into huge detail about things. You've just got to get to the punchlines, basically.
As quickly as possible.
Yeah.
As succinctly as possible.
Exactly, yeah.
And because the last time I saw you doing a full 20-minute set was when you'd come back from Bali just after the bombing.
Oh,
and
right,
I think
yeah.
You did 20 minutes on that. And it was within about 10 days or something?
Yeah, that's about right, yeah. But the trouble that there's 2 things wrong with that, and one is that not everybody can relate to Bali. Although it was all in the news and everybody knew a bomb had gone off in Bali, people don't know the ins and outs of it, so even then I had to edit out a lot of references that I'd like to have done, places, events, because they wouldn't know who I was talking about. You know, if I was saying I was on the north shore of Bali, you'd spend 5 minutes explaining
what that meant, that's
not Kuta Beach, that's where the bomb went off Kuta Beach, that is. Where I was before was in West Papua New Guinea. Now you get into a different field there. So, yeah, if you saw me do 20 minutes about it, that would be the edited version of what I got up to in Bali. I mean, for some countries, I mean, the best example for me is South Africa. I went down there knowing nothing about South Africa, and I did 28 nights down there. When I came back, my entire show was about South Africa, of which about 5 lines work in England. You know, you can do a throwaway line about safari, because everyone knows about safaris. You can do a line about Nelson Mandela, again, a bomb going off in Planet Hollywood. But the rest of it, nobody knows what you're on about. You really have to cut out all the integral bits to make it funny. But yeah, that's why when I'm overseas, I'm in my element because I write local stuff.
I was going to say, about the barley stuff, I was really impressed that you did 20 minutes of really tightly, what looked to me like tightly honed material, 10 days after having come back. And I would guess most of the people in the audience did get what you were talking about.
Yeah, because it was a major world event.
Right.
I mean, I was in Bali 3 weeks ago, a month ago, when the earthquake happened in Yogyakarta. I should have been there that day, and I wasn't, just by chance. I got an extra gig in Jakarta. So when I did my next show in Jakarta, I had about 10 minutes about the earthquake and how I'd narrowly missed dying in an earthquake. Over here, it was in the papers for one day.
Yeah.
6,000 people died.
Yeah.
But it was in the paper for one day. Yeah. And I bet if most people in the world outside of Indonesia, I said, have you ever heard of Yogyakarta? They go, oh, Jakarta, I've heard of it. No, Yogyakarta. It means nothing to them, even though 6,000 people died that day. And no Westerners were fools.
Which is partly the reason why it's probably not kept in the press a bit longer. But you obviously, I would suggest from where I'm standing that you find it quite easy to write material.
I do, yeah. The reason I find it easy is because I'm an inherently funny person. I mean, I didn't know that until I did my first sort of one-man show in Edinburgh, and one of my school friends turned up. And afterwards he said to me, oh, we always thought you'd be a comedian. I said, well, why didn't you tell me? I didn't know that. I was just the mouthy lad at the back of the class. I didn't know that I was funny. But I now know that, you know, when I read my army report, when you leave the army, you get a report that sums up your career. And it said, ironically, it's quite funny looking back, because it says, Sigmund Pearson, which was my name and rank, it said, served in many theatres, or it's what they call places of war, and managed to keep his humour under pressure. And I think, well, yeah, I was that sort of person anyway. The more pressure you put on me, the more I react with humour. There's no point in getting down about things. Life goes on.
It's not your default mechanism. Yours is to make it funny.
Look on the bright side. I mean, even, you know, I'm writing a book about the Falklands at the moment. I haven't even got to the Falklands. I've written 4 chapters about how I was getting there, and already I've got publishers interested because I write as I talk, and I'm a funny person in that regard. I don't see the downside of things. I only see the upside.
Because I would say that's probably the comics, most comics I speak to, that's the thing they find hardest, is to come up with material. And that's either because they are very young and they haven't had much experience to draw on, or they just find the sweat of turning something that they do want to make funny.
Well, it's different. People have got different styles. And when I first started, my close friend at the time, we started exactly the same day as Dominic Holland.
We made
our debut the same night. He is extremely structured. He'll ask a question to you and say, does anyone on the circuit do jokes about grandfather clocks? And you go, no, I don't think so. Well, that's what I'm going to write tomorrow. So here, go away and write a series of very good, very well-structured jokes about grandfather clocks, because that's what he's decided to do. He's up at 8 in the morning, out with the laptop. That's what he does. All my material comes from wandering the streets, sometimes with a drink in my hand, and suddenly I start laughing at something, or I spot something that just appeals to me. And my way of doing it is to, I'm not dyslexic, so writing it down is pointless. I normally speak it into a dictaphone, or I ring my own aunt's phone and leave a message and just say the phrase that made me laugh, or what, you know. I mean, I was on a train the other day, a plane that was stuck on the runway for 7 hours in Bournemouth. It was no fun whatsoever, but I've got loads of gadgets for music. I've got a PSP, PlayStation, I've got a laptop, you know. But the woman behind me was getting very, very frustrated, and we've been told the reason we're grounded is because there's been a massive storm over London. Every airport in London has been shut down, Stansted, Luton, Heathrow, Gatwick. And nobody believed it. We honestly believed something major had happened, security scandal, you know. We're in beautiful blue skies in Bournemouth for 7 hours, and yet apparently there's this massive storm over London. So this woman gets on her mobile phone and rings British Rail and said, look, I'm in Bournemouth, can you tell me, are the trains running from starting to London? And the woman said, yeah, absolutely. She said, and can you tell me what the weather's like in London? You know, with an ulterior motive of finding out what's going on. And the woman said, I'm afraid I can't tell you that. And she said, ah, I see. Have you got a security restriction? She went, no, I'm in India. the helplines in India. Now, the woman was annoyed by that. Me, I'm going, oh, I've got to write that down. That is funny, you know?
Yeah.
Now, that's how I get my material. Overhearing things, seeing things, or interpreting things different ways, you know? If you've got a comic mind, you see things differently from other people.
Yeah.